Since we started this study, what we've been looking at thus far is a presentation of the gospel as you find it both in the New Testament and looking at this from the standpoint of whether or not we have any solid reason to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. I'm convinced that we do, and I trust that most of us were probably already cognizant of the fact that we do have such an abundance of evidence and we ought to be familiar with it. But as I said when we started this study, if you believe without question, then you believe without answers. And I'm afraid that a lot of times people just accept it without pondering whether or not there really is a good reason beyond. That's just what the Word tells me to believe. Hopefully the studies we've had thus far would convince us that we do have evidence and we need to know what that evidence is. And today we begin a presentation of that evidence. In 1 Corinthians 15 and in verse 3, Paul said to the Corinthians, "I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that He was buried, that He was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures." And then in verse 5, we won't read the rest of what he says there, but there's that first phrase we want to pay attention to, "and that He appeared." I'm going to use the phrase "the kernel of the gospel" to refer to the four facts that we have in verse 3 through verse 5, actually all the way down to verse 8 or so. Jesus died, Jesus was buried, Jesus arose, and He appeared. Now, if we were to just take the resurrection, break it all down into the essential elements that actually play a role in our salvation, I might not list it with these four. I might say the crucifixion, the death of Jesus, that's a key part of it because that's the moment when He gave His life in atonement, the resurrection of Jesus when He conquered death, and then the ascension of Jesus when He went back to heaven in order to mediate for our sins. I might break it down that way. The fact that Jesus was buried does not take away my sins. I don't know of any aspect of the gospel that says that. But I'm referring to these four facts in this way for now as the kernel of the gospel because, one, that's how Paul articulates it. But, two, there's a logic to it. If Jesus died, burial confirms that He died. Why? Because burial is how Jews got rid of a dead body. We do the exact same thing 2,000 years later. If Jesus arose from the dead, the proof of that are the appearances that He made that are recorded for us in the Gospels, in the book of Acts, in this list that we have in 1 Corinthians 15, where we are right now. So the appearances are proof of life, which we need, and the burial is proof of death. So we'll begin an examination of these four things this morning. We want to look at some other things that will be on the addendum that was handed out to you first. So if you have a copy of that, go ahead and look at that first. If you don't, who doesn't? You got it? Okay. Raise your hand and John will get you a copy of that. The beauty of making this class up as you go is you can change it and do whatever you want to with it on the fly. And that's what I'm doing. I originally thought I would look at this lesson over two classes. I think it's going to take a little bit longer than that. And I'll condense some other stuff down the road. But for now, when we think of the kernel of the gospel, I want you to think of these four things. He died, He was buried, He arose, and He appeared. And I'm stressing that because, Lord willing, we'll come back and talk about five stubborn facts later on. And there's a lot of overlap, but they're not exactly the same thing. And the five stubborn facts really support exactly what you see here in 1 Corinthians 15. And the five stubborn facts are how I would make the case to someone that doesn't agree at the outset that Jesus actually came back from the dead. And we'll talk about that later. Today we want to start an overview of the six texts that record the death, burial, resurrection, and appearances of Christ. And as we progress in this study, when we finish this, we want to start raising some critical questions. Who wrote these books? How do I know they're trustworthy? Are they as old as I ought to think that they are? Did they really come from the first century? If they didn't, that casts a shadow of doubt over whether or not I can believe in them. Are they reliable? These are the kinds of things that we want to start working through after we look and just see what they have to say. Take your Bible and open up to the Gospel of Luke chapter 1. We'll go over the stuff on the addendum sheet first. You might call these principles of historiography. You know, what this is basically is just some guiding precepts in the study of history. How do people who study history, who look at what really happened, how do they go about determining what did happen? As we talked about in a previous study, you can't scientifically prove that George Washington lived and that he died. You have to use another means to establish truth in that regard. And the means by which people go about approaching what did happen, what's the probability that something did happen, you're going to find that the Bible gives us an abundance of evidence that satisfies that sort of criteria. First of all, this. We have six texts that talk about these four things. And we won't get into an in-depth study of each of the texts. I've broken them down at the top of the lesson on page 8. But if you look on page 11 on the addendum, testimony that's attested to by multiple independent witnesses is usually considered stronger than the testimony of one witness. Put another way, if you're a prosecutor in a court of law and you want to prove that someone is guilty of a crime, you want to have five or six people you can call on to testify that he's guilty versus one. And the reason for that, strengthening your case, should be obvious to everybody. This has been a standard of prosecution for thousands and thousands of years. If you were a Jew living in the time of Moses and you witnessed a murder and you witnessed a murder alone, was that enough evidence to convict and sentence a man to death?
No.
No, it was not. No, it was not. Anybody could take advantage of that system in order to manipulate it to take out a rival or an adversary. And God decided that there needed to be a large amount of direct evidence on a certain standard in order to take away a man or a woman's life. Even when people are not guided in their thinking by what God has said in His book, they still recognize commonsensically it's better to have a ton of witnesses on your side if you're going to make the case. Well, what do we have? Matthew and John. John was an eyewitness. John alone, from what we can tell in the text, of our gospel authors, of the people that record these, the kernel of the gospel for us, was present at the crucifixion. He was present when the spear pierced his side. And he said, I'm writing these things that you may believe. That is, that you may believe that he was dead. Believe it or not, that was a point of contention, evidently. Later on in the first century, perhaps, that Jesus died in a fleshly body. Matthew, being an apostle, would have been an eyewitness. Both of these men would have been present for some of the appearances of Jesus Christ at the exact same time. When Jesus appeared to them all of a sudden in the room, the night that Thomas was absent, they would have also been there when Thomas was there later on. Mark, what kind of witness was he? Was he an eyewitness?
No.
Not so far as we know, right? There is some evidence within the Gospel of Mark that he probably did get a lot of his information from one such eyewitness, though. Peter. And hopefully we'll get to look at some of that later on. In Luke chapter 1, Luke is up front about where he's coming from and all this. Is he an eyewitness?
No.
No, he's not. So does that mean we ought to just dismiss what he says outright?
No.
Why not? Investigated everything carefully from what kind of sources?
Eyewitnesses.
Eyewitnesses. We call that a primary source. That's really what you want. It's really what you want in the study of history. You really want that as much as you can in a court of law. If there was a traffic accident, a hit and run, and the person that hit the pedestrian fled the scene, but somebody, there may have been a witness also that saw it, but for whatever reason they also left the scene after waiting around. Maybe they called 911, but there was a family emergency and they had to go. But before they left, maybe they talked to somebody else that pulled up. And they said, what happened? Let me tell you what happened. I got to go. When the police show up, they may talk to that person that has the account of what happened secondhand. They can talk to them and they can find out, at least establish something did happen and what happened, but they're still going to want to talk to the person that actually witnessed it. Hopefully that person thought to leave some contact information or something. They're going to do what they can to follow up. With Luke, he, by reading his document, you can at least establish that something did happen, and you can corroborate it with what you read in Matthew and John, because they are eyewitnesses, and Luke says he spoke to eyewitnesses. Look in the letter D on number one here. This one is really interesting. We have Paul. He claims to be an eyewitness of the resurrected Jesus Christ. What's notable about him is he's not even a disciple when he says that he saw Jesus. He's a violent persecutor. A man that says that Jesus would have agreed readily that he was a heretic and that those that followed him had been terribly deceived. All right, secondly, look at Matthew chapter 28. As much as possible, we want an abundance of eyewitness testimony. And with the gospel accounts of the death, burial, resurrection, and appearances of Jesus, you have it. You have it secondhand through the writings of Luke and Mark. You have it in primary source documents from Matthew and John, as well as from Paul. Secondly, affirmation by a neutral or hostile source is usually considered stronger than affirmation from a friendly source, since bias in favor of the person or position is absent. Let me put that in plain English. What this means is, if my mom told you that I was a good person, you could believe her if you wanted to, but maybe with some reservations. Why? She's my mother. What if it was somebody that hated my guts? What if they said I was a good person? Would that maybe strengthen what you heard about me from my mom? Yeah. Why? Could you accuse them of being biased in my favor? They don't like me. This was true in the 1700s with John Adams and Alexander Hamilton. Those two guys did not like each other. And John Adams was a contentious man. He was very stubborn, and people liked to make fun of him. And Hamilton was an adversary politically against him, wanted to sabotage him when they had a falling out. But even Hamilton never accused Adams of things like political corruption. Couldn't stand the guy, but didn't say that he was crooked. At least had some respect for his character. So if even an adversary says good things about you, well, I think that strengthens the case overall, doesn't it? Look at Matthew chapter 28. This is after the tomb is found empty. You remember that the Jews had a guard stationed. They wanted to prevent the body from being stolen. This is what they think could happen. This is what they fear would happen. The whole point of putting Jesus on the cross and killing him in the first place was to discredit the movement. But if his disciples come later on and take the body, well, as they said, the last deception might be worse than the first. When they find out that the body has been removed from the tomb, they tell the guards, "You are to say his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep." A lot of questions about that. How would a bunch of men who were asleep even know what happened? But just stop and think about what they've admitted. What have they admitted?
They were asleep.
Not that they were asleep.
Tomb
is empty. Uh-oh. Now maybe they disagree over how it came to be that way. But I tell you what, if somebody in the first century had found the body of Jesus, that would have killed Christianity right there. At the very minimum, here are people who were responsible for him being put in the tomb in the first place. And even they are admitting, by manufacturing this lie, we don't know where the body is. Now, if I believe in the kernel of the gospel, I'm going to believe that the tomb is found empty, that there is no body in there. We also have...
John.
Yes. Right, right. We, alongside this, we have the testimony of Paul. It's remarkable enough that you have the disciples of Jesus saying that he's back from the dead. And that's remarkable because did any of them expect him to come back from the dead? Just a minute, Dylan, I'll get to you. Did anybody expect him to come back? No, they did not. But now you have a guy who didn't sit at Jesus' feet for 3.5 years. He says he came back from the dead. This is a guy that was standing there when they stoned Stephen to death. He says he's back. Dylan. Sure. I mean, they would be admitting to a dereliction of duty by agreeing to go along. That's it. Yeah. Their life would also be forfeit by going around and spreading this story. So this raises a lot of questions about whether or not we can trust that the story of the empty tomb is true, and it ought to be a comfort to us when even the adversaries of Jesus are saying the exact same thing. As I said in a previous lesson, if you look at letter C there, these sources don't confirm that Jesus came back from the dead, but we want to look at them in a later study. We at least have secular sources that confirm he died by crucifixion. And that's helpful to us as well. That's part of the kernel of the gospel. Jesus died. There are people that say Jesus didn't even live. That's foolishness. If you can prove that a man died, by extension, you've proved that he lived. Jesus did live, and he did die, and more specifically, he died on a cross. Surely a means that would have killed a man. Yes, he died. Yes, you can believe that. Look in John chapter 20. We have that too. We have the appearance to 500 in 1 Corinthians 15. Look at John chapter 20. Third thing about this. People usually don't make up details regarding a story that would tend to weaken their position. You might think, well, what about those guards back there that we just talked about in Matthew 28? But the Jews promised them, we would get you out of trouble if any of this got back to Pilate. Yes, they did that too. In the case of the disciples, though, preaching the gospel, there's nobody guaranteeing their protection. There's nobody guaranteeing that they will spare them from the justice system such as it was back then. These are people that simply want to go around teaching and preaching the gospel, and they're prepared to face the consequences. Now, one of the things that people say is they just made it all up. They told a lie. Well, if you're making up a story, why would you invent something that's going to raise questions? And the things that we have here, they raise questions. For example, in John 20 and verse 11, Mary was standing outside the tomb weeping, and so as she wept, she stooped and looked into the tomb. She saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and one at the feet where the body of Jesus had been lying. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "Because they've taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus. Well, why didn't she know that it wasn't? Why didn't she know that it was Jesus?
He wasn't expecting
him. Now, that may have been part of it.
We really don't know that.
We don't know. Does John ever say why she didn't know that that was Jesus? You might think, well, this whole thing is about this man coming back from the dead, and she's been with this man, sat at his feet, knows him, loved him, cared about him. Why didn't she recognize him instantly? Don't know. It is troubling. It is perplexing. But at the very least, what it might tell me is John is only interested in telling the facts. Even if he can't always explain them, even if he doesn't know why certain things worked out the way they did, and even if it might beg the question of why? It doesn't make any sense, John. Even John might have to say, "I don't know. Let me just tell you what happened." Herb.
Well, just because she didn't know, I don't think it discredited what he risen. That's the point, main point. Whether she figured out if she knew who he was or not, it really doesn't matter. The main point of it is that God did what he said, going to raise Jesus up. So I think that would be the most important thing to be concerned about, my God.
The main thing is that he was raised. The question for us is, how do we know that? We know that because of the people that testified they saw him come back from the dead. And in Mary's case, she does come to recognize that it is him. We don't know why she didn't at first, but the credit to our faith is, here's a woman that did know him, and finally the light goes on, yes, that's him. Yes, I know he's back. That's the comfort for us, even if we don't know why this happens at first. Look at Luke 24, very similar occurrence. Luke 24 and verse 13. These are two disciples on the road to Emmaus. One of them is named Cleopas. This is after Jesus' resurrection from the dead. In verse 13, two of them were going that very day to a village named Emmaus, which was about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about all these things which had taken place. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself approached and began traveling with them, but their eyes were prevented from recognizing him. Why? Don't know. Luke never says. Jesus never says. Nobody ever explains it. It's weird. And if I was the one writing the Bible back then, that's not the kind of thing I would even be interested in. I want to know more about the man's life before he was 30 years old. Why are you telling me about these two guys that had this resurrection encounter with Jesus, but they don't even know who he is at first? For a couple of hours, maybe. I don't know. But I do know people usually don't make things up regarding a story that would tend to weaken their position. Why would you invite that kind of criticism and skepticism unless you're just trying to tell the truth? Look at John 19. The fourth thing is that eyewitness testimony is usually considered stronger than testimony heard from a second or third hand source. That doesn't mean that second and third hand testimony should be dismissed altogether. Luke is a second hand account, but in a lot of ways it's way more detailed than the two primary documents, Matthew and John. Luke is the only one that gives a detailed account of the birth of John the Baptist and Jesus Christ. An extensive detailed account of both and how they overlapped. And that's a credit to the fact that he claimed to do extensive research in his writing. So just because you have a second or third-hand account doesn't mean that it's not reliable or trustworthy. The point we're making is simply that an eyewitness account, you really want that if you can get it. And if you've got it, what an advantage you have. At John chapter 19 and verse 32, the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first man and of the other who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. And you'd break a man's legs to speed up the process of death. Guys could hang on the cross 2 or 3 days before they would die. Jesus died in a remarkably quick amount of time for someone that had been crucified compared to the rate at which other men would finally give up the ghost. In verse 34, they do something to confirm death. Can't take his pulse, so what do? He's hanging up there. One of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear. Immediately blood and water came out. And he who has seen has testified. His testimony is true. He knows he's telling the truth so that you also may believe. I was there. I saw it happen. Guys that had torture and murder as their business by trade, these Roman soldiers, they knew what they were doing. They confirmed that they had succeeded in their mission, that they killed him. And I was there, and I'm telling you about it so you'd believe it. You want eyewitness testimony? You've got it. In John's Gospel, in Matthew's Gospel, you got it in Paul's, not with the death burial of Jesus, but with his resurrection, with his appearances. But finally, number 5, look back in 1 Corinthians 15 for a moment. 'Early testimony from very close to the event in question is usually considered more reliable than one received years after the event.' Why do you think that is?
Because
things are still fresh. Yeah, things are still fresh, or at least they're fresher than what they might otherwise be. I was just thinking the other day, I mean, there's whole months of this year, I don't even know what I've done. Last year, years ago, and I don't think I've got Alzheimer's, you know, but I have a hard time recalling certain things now. What if we could only be certain that the documents that we have in our lap in the form of the New Testament, that they came 300 or 400 years later? That would not necessarily mean that they recorded events that didn't happen. But what if you had an unusual circumstance where you had an ancient book that shows up within decades of the events? In the ancient world, that's a news flash. We're used to instantaneous updates on our smartphones. You may even get them while you're sitting in church if something big happens. In the Dark Ages, people had to go to the newspaper the next day and find out what happened by going to get a copy of the Houston Chronicle. In the ancient world, news moved really, really slow. But what if you had this one book that showed up pretty quick compared to everybody else, within a few decades? That's what you have in the New Testament. There is an event that is predicted in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that is not recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And because it's not recorded, it leads us to believe that those books were written before a certain year in the first century. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Destruction of Jerusalem. Yeah, which happened when?
70
AD. So each one of those books predicts that that will happen. None of them recorded happening. Had it happened by the time they were written, you'd know they would have talked about that. A sequel to Luke, the book of Acts, goes all the way up into the early 60s, does not record the destruction of Jerusalem, likely would have done that, as it is a pertinent event to the gospel in the first century, doesn't do it. So we have very, very early books. Keith, can you tell us when 1 Corinthians was written? Maybe not? Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's it. 57 AD. So look in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 3. I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received. And then we have the kernel of the gospel. At least by 57 AD, people were saying that Jesus came back from the dead. At least by then. Now, what sometimes people say is, well, that was just added on to it later. Yes, there was a man, Jesus. Yes, he went to the cross, but he didn't come back from the dead. He was a great teacher, great person. Everybody loved him. They wanted him to come back, but he didn't. So they just added all this and embellished it. As years go by and people's memories get dim and more people die, more legends get added to it. Here's a man in 57 AD who says, this is the gospel as it was given to me. Now, we may wonder exactly who Paul is talking about when he says he received it. Who did he receive it from? Look in Galatians chapter 1. Yes.
According to the scriptures. So they're going back and you're talking about things that happened that they were eyewitnesses to, but confirmed by, this is according to scripture, and your point about the New Testament being is older than what we have. Jesus had confidence that things written by Moses and David were still true in the first century.
Right.
You know, and
right.
They could rely on those scriptures.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a good thing for us, according to the scriptures, we can go back and study, and then the eyewitnesses and what happened just like it said.
Right. Good observation to make. For our purposes in this study, for better or worse, I'm not going to spend much time on the Old Testament and what it says about Jesus. And I know we've had a lot of good observations made about that, and there is definitely a place for that in making the case for Christ. I'm not going to spend much time on that because I want to spend more time on the New Testament itself. We will talk a little bit about how you can know that those Old Testament prophecies of Jesus were written at least 150 to 200 years before he was born. And I think that's helpful because a lot of times people say, just like they say this was all invented after the fact, these books were written after the fact. Somebody really creative came along and edited them all together to make it look like there's this seamless story from Genesis to Revelation about Jesus going to the cross and coming back from the dead. That is just ahistorical. You say that because you've either been deceived or you are a deceiver, one or the other. And there's no substantiation for that. Look in Galatians chapter 1. Now here is Paul, and he says in verse 12, referring to the gospel that was preached, he said in verse 12, I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. When he says in 1 Corinthians 15 he received it, That may be exactly who he's talking about, that ultimately it came from Jesus, or it came from Jesus directly with no mediators in between, that is, no apostles. There are some people that would say in verse 12 that Paul is just simply mistaken. He didn't get it from Jesus Christ. They would say that Paul did live and Paul converted from Judaism to Christianity, but he did not get this special direct revelation from the Lord. Interestingly, though, they would go on down further in the text and they would read about Paul's conversion story. He talks about how in verse 15 he was set apart. The Lord was revealed to him in verse 16. And in verse 17 he says, "I did not go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me. I went away to Arabia and returned once more to Damascus. Then 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas and stayed with him 15 days. By the time that he meets with Cephas, and give me another name for Cephas. Who's he talking about there? Peter. So this would be somebody that would have also claimed to be an eyewitness, right? By the time he meets with Peter in verse 18, this is roughly 34 AD, somewhere in there. Jesus goes to the cross about 30 AD. At the very latest, within 4 years, this message of the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus was being preached. Paul would have known that himself because within those first 4 years, he was busy putting Christians to death. And he couldn't get them to break. Would they have broken if they at least didn't believe that Jesus came back from the dead? You may question whether or not he came back from the dead, but I don't know how you can question that they believed he did. That doesn't make sense. They at least believed it. Whether it's true or not, that may be open for debate with other people. But if they at least believed it, it shows you that from the earliest days of Christianity, what were people saying? He's back from the dead. From the earliest days. Not that this was made up later and then tacked on centuries down the road. All right. So we've got about 10 minutes. Any thoughts, questions, comments about what we've discussed, Steve?
I'm getting ahead of you. Stop me, okay?
Okay.
You made an excellent observation that lends credibility to these historical documents based on what they did include. It seems to me, at least, one of the strongest things that lends credibility to these documents is the one thing they did not include. These five writers, this was dear to their hearts, gave their lives for it, willing to die for it. So if it's a concocted story, like Paul said, I got it from the Lord, if he didn't, he made it up, there's one thing none of them recorded. No eyewitness of the resurrection itself.
Right. Yeah. Nobody is there present.
Five writers omit that.
Right.
They were making up the story.
Right. Yeah. That is one of the interesting things about it, and it's notated on the discussion of the resurrection. There's nobody there when the pulse comes back into his flesh. Nobody's got their finger on his wrist. That does not happen. And you may think, well, that is strange. Why not record it? And then there's other things about that, like the stone in front of the tomb being removed as well, and what the logic might be behind that. Excellent point that Steve makes. If it is made up, you would expect to find that in there. Keith?
Well, you're talking about not being an eyewitness, but being a kind of a secondary source. You know, we think about if you were wanting a secondary source, somebody who would be objective, somebody who would be smart, who would be intelligent enough to see deception, you would want somebody like Luke, who was a physician. All right, he wrote two books. He wrote Luke, and then he wrote Acts. The thing is he went through these eyewitness accounts as a physician, somebody who would be an expert in whether somebody died and then somebody who was raised again. He would be the one you would want to go to. And if anybody was going to be buffaloed, you would want him to be the one to test that, because if he thinks it's true, we should believe it. Along with that, seeing as he wrote one of the Gospels and then he wrote Acts, it's interesting to me, even though he was a secondary source, how everything fits and weaves together so well. If you went to Galatians, where Paul is mentioning the fact that he received it from Jesus. Well, in Acts 26, Luke records that Acts 26:16, Paul talking to Agrippa says, "But get up and stand on your feet, for this purpose I have appeared to you to appoint you as a minister and a witness not only to the things which you have seen, but also to the things in which I will appear to you. Paul writes it to the Galatian brother, and Luke records it in Acts. These things wouldn't fit together so well and weave together so well if they were, I don't think you could fabricate it. I mean, just the way that Paul writing to one group of people, Luke writing to Theophilus. I think that as a secondary source, he would be the best secondary source you could ever have because of his profession. And I just thought that would be relevant to the conversation.
Sure, there's a lot of things that increase his credibility. You mentioned his profession. He's also an outsider. He's Gentile. So he's, in a lot of ways, that's helpful. He can maintain an objective view about these people, their culture, their background, without it feeling precious to him, like he's got to protect it or anything like that, their Jewish traditions or anything. He's in an ideal place to be able to record a document like that. And we do have a remarkable harmony within our text, as well as what's been called undesigned coincidences that run throughout it as well. Yes. Alex, did you have your hand up?
Well, I'm debating an atheist that constantly he's always bringing up the fact that the apostles did not recognize Christ when he was resurrected. Mary didn't recognize Christ when he was resurrected. And that seems to be, that's the impasse we're at in the debate there.
Well, my first question to him might be, so what? And I'm not saying that to be flippant, but these are people that went to the cross themselves, in a manner of speaking, put their own lives on the line, in many cases gave it up because they were convinced that they saw Jesus come back from the dead. And it's hard to fathom in my mind that an alternative explanation such as an imposter, who they might try to say would explain why they didn't recognize him at first, how he could maintain that level of identity theft over an extended period.
I saw the miracles right there prove that it's not impossible.
We want to look some more further down at the appearances. We'll offer a few suggestions on why Mary might not have recognized him at first. And I don't know that I have anything to offer in the case of the other men on the road to Emmaus, but there may be some reasons why it was not readily apparent to some of them why they couldn't see. But there's such a mountain of evidence otherwise that would confirm their testimony.
What you said earlier is useful to Alex if he'll use it. Why did they record that if it's a false document?
Right. Yeah.
They would not have put it that way. And then you made another point that these guys were willing to die for their faith later if it was a fabricated thing. That doesn't fit.
Right. Yeah. You're left with either the explanation that these men are deceivers or they're crazy. But it's hard to read the writings of a man like Paul and conclude that he's irrational. And it's hard to think that men that created a virtuous moral code would be willing to suffer and die for what they knew to be a lie, that they had a willing hand in. So, good points that Steve makes. All right, yes, Craig.
I was just going to say a suggestion about the road, the two men on the road. Maybe you'll address this later. Jesus couldn't have had the conversation some of the Jewish men during that day that were contemplating the resurrection of Jesus, the things that were being talked about, Jesus being raised. He couldn't have had that conversation if they recognized him right off the bat. It would have been a different conversation. I think there's some insight into what's going on between those that are being taught the gospel and being convinced in their hearts to believe in Jesus, the risen Savior.
There's certainly a method to it. Whether we readily understand why things worked out that way or not, there's certainly a reason for it. And whether it's because, as you said, that conversation would have been completely different had they known who he was right off the bat, that may well be it. Look in Luke chapter 22. At least want to touch on the first thing we have on the death of Jesus. From what we have in our gospel accounts, the medical evidence for the suffering and death of Jesus is overwhelming. And this is not even... That's without even considering the secular testimony of enemies of Christianity in the first century that testify that Jesus did die by crucifixion. Let's talk a little bit about some of the things that we have as far as medical details into what happened to our Lord. At chapter 22 and verse 44, this is just before his betrayal. He's praying in the garden. Being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. It may be, I'm not convinced that this has to be it. It may be that he had a rare medical condition even in this moment, brought on by physical, mental stress and anguish with the knowledge of what he was about to go through. I say that it doesn't have to be that way, because what you have here is a simile. Sweat became like drops of blood. That doesn't necessarily mean that he was sweating blood. Sometimes, though, in the Bible, a simile is also literally true. Herod was afraid to lay hands on John the Baptist because the people regarded him as a prophet. That's a simile. It's also literally true. He was a prophet. So maybe, maybe not, but we'll consider it anyway. This condition is referred to as hematidrosis. I think I'm saying that right. Or hemohidrosis. You begin to sweat or excrete blood or blood pigment in your sweat. This is brought on by periods of great emotional stress. In 1585, there was a Catholic nun that was being threatened by soldiers. They had swords. She was so terrified that she bled from every part of her body and died of hemorrhage in the sight of her assailants. They didn't have to lay hands on her. Just the fear of what she was about to experience killed her right there. In World War I, there was a girl that had a terrible fear of air raids, and she developed this condition after a gas explosion occurred in the house next door to hers. At the end of the 20th century, there were 76 cases that had been studied, and they had been grouped according to what caused them. The cause was acute fear and intense mental contemplation. So if Jesus is sweating blood, you can't look at this and think necessarily that he's experienced a severe loss of blood in this moment. This is not like the nun that I just referenced. What it does mean, if he is sweating blood, his skin would have been very tender and fragile. Now, that's bad for him because of the scourging that he's going to experience later on, before he even goes to the cross, before the nails are even placed into his hands and his feet. If you look in Matthew chapter 26, we'll talk about this and then we'll finish our class. Verse 67, we have physical abuse at his trial. Trial is in quotes. This is an illegal trial. This is not carrying out of justice. This is just cold-blooded murder. And they're putting a rubber stamp on it. They spat on his face. They beat him with their fists. And others slapped him. We don't know to what degree he was beaten. We don't know how bad the blows were. This is the first time that he's beaten. A second beating is recorded later when the Roman soldiers place the crown of thorns on his head and the purple robe on him and begin to mock him. What we do know is that at the hour of the trial, which is in the dead of night, and then the next day being brought before Pilate, Jesus has not had any sleep from the night that he's been betrayed all the way through leading up into what's coming next. I don't know about you, but I do not always think clearly when I've gone without sleep. And it's remarkable that Jesus has even got the wits that he has when he's on the cross, given everything that he goes through. But it surely would have made, in his mental state, his sufferings that much worse and the pain that much more aggravated. Thank you for your time and your attention this morning.